Hello, everybody. It's the second Tuesday of the month, for once happening before the second Monday, and this is Understanding Autism. I'm Paul Loudon, and I'm here with Kim Isaac.
Hi. Good afternoon, everybody. Today, we have a really exciting show. We have a guest from calling in from Canada. He is an autism consultant and a good friend of mine, and he has quite an extensive experience and bio, and so I just want to introduce him. Actually, John, are you there on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. Hi. I know. We're so excited to have you.
Well, I'm excited to be here.
So I want to give you a proper introduction here. So you're currently the vice president at Brookfield Programs in Toronto, and you have been educated at the University of Toronto, McGill, Yale, and University of North Texas. You've held academic posts in political science, public administration, and health promotion, as well as senior executive positions within Ontario Public Service. You just have, I mean, that's just half of it. So should I do the whole thing? I guess to give people a great idea, I mean, you're not only are you just actively involved in the community and a professional in the community, you're also a parent of an adult with autism.
That's right. And
yeah.
I think the point to be made about sort of my CV is that I'm a big believer in experience-based learning.
Yes.
And I think that that's apropos to what apropos of what I want to speak to today.
Yes.
And that dealing with some of the issues that are arising for adults with autism requires breaking out of the box and thinking through some of the issues in a different way than the way we've approached them before.
Yes. Yes, very much so. Before we get into talking about that, can you tell us a little bit more about the Brookfield programs that you're involved in?
Oh, it's a clinic in Toronto that provides intervention for ASD. And as you know, I'm a relationship development consultant. And I think that the thing that characterizes our approach to autism is that we take the notion of having to treat autism seriously, that we are committed to the understanding and analysis of autism as a developmental disability, and as such, that leads us in other directions, as you know, to take seriously cognitive developmental approaches to get at the underlying core deficits.
Right, right. So, you know, along these lines here, so I know we have a really important topic that you're going to discuss with us today. And, you know, talking about the seriousness of autism and, you know, how people view it, you know, autism is also, is often linked to a disorder of childhood.
Yeah.
And this is a huge point, you know, in itself, and it relates directly to what we want to talk about today. And
I think,
yes.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right for a whole series of reasons. It has been characterized primarily as a disorder of childhood. And as a result, our investments, the resources that we've been able to allocate to dealing with autism have focused on early intervention.
Yes.
And I don't begrudge that. I think that's really important. And I think as a result, many children are doing much better than they might have done otherwise. But with this first wave of children who are part of the autism epidemic, and I truly believe it is an epidemic coming of age now, we're realizing that the outcomes are not as good as we would have hoped.
Right.
And I think as a result, we are not prepared for that first wave.
So when we're talking about outcomes, like, let's talk about when you say outcomes, you know, and as, you know, these children are growing up, we're looking at things such as employment and being able to, you know, live independently and, you know, take care of themselves in multiple ways.
Uh-huh.
And so despite some of the early intervention, while it's helped them, there's definitely some, you know, serious problems in those areas in adulthood. And that's what you're referring to?
That's right.
Yes.
In fact, because there have been lots of gains made by individuals on the spectrum through early intervention in alleviating many of the symptoms of autism. And there have been significant gains, for example, in some instances on cognitive ability as measured by traditional IQ tests or adaptive ability. But nonetheless, we still see that many of these individuals, despite their gains, still are showing up as unable to live what we would consider independent lives, say, for example, the ability to get and to hold a job. Mm-hmm. Now, there are numerous other factors involved in the difficulties that people with disabilities in general and people with autism in particular have at gaining entry to the labor market, but we're not seeing really significant gains in the what we would call quality of life indicators.
Right.
That are associated with adulthood?
Yes, yes. And those are the things. I mean, how are you, I know we're talking about so adulthood and quality of life and, you know, obtaining and maintaining employment. And I think there's even more to it than that. You know, the emotional side of being out in the world, you know, and feeling like a contributor of society and feeling connected and accepted and understood. You know, and being able to understand what you're going through, you know, in your day-to-day life.
Yeah, it's clear that the social impairment in autism is primary, and it is the most difficult to deal with, and it is the driver for success, or alternatively, it's sort of the factor that underlies a lot of the difficulties that people have with moving through the lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the conclusion to draw is, you know, not to undermine early intervention, though we certainly could have, I think, a lively discussion on the nature of early intervention and the type of intervention that might prove to be most productive.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, that's a separate debate. I think the issue I want to get into today is that we are going to have large numbers of people who have made various gains, who reach the age of 18 or 20 or, you know, whatever the cutoff age is for services in various states or provinces. And then, as many parents say, they just fall off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
There's absolutely nothing for them to do. And I think the first thing is to reconceptualize autism, at least at this point into the near future, as a chronic lifelong condition,
mm-hmm.
whereby people with autism, despite many significant gains, still require various levels of support,
right,
and resources in order to move forward, either not to lose those gains or to make further gains.
And I think it's important, too, to emphasize that the varying degrees component, because I think a lot of people have an all-or-nothing mentality of this person's either living independently or they're not. You know, but it's important to emphasize that varying degrees, and that's not a bad thing. It's not a negative thing.
No, we all need degrees of support. We may be able to achieve that support independently through our own activities, or we may need people to help us realize what support we need and engage with us in a relationship to help realize that support. I think what we're looking at here, to just follow up on that point, is a different way of conceptualizing what we mean by support. I happen to think that the best way to move forward in terms of adult services is to look at the resources and support that people with autism need through the prism of the principles of RDI, because that is based, I think, on a much more sophisticated and in-depth analysis of the nature of autism,
right,
as a developmental disability. And I think it also gives us scope to deal with that question of the variation between people. I mean, one of the things that people always talk about when they talk about autism, or should be talking about when they talk about autism, though in fact it sometimes gets lost or it's paid lip service to, is that phrase you hear people saying, if you met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And that is absolutely true. The range of symptoms associated with autism are, you know, incredibly varied. from people who are nonverbal, who have enormous difficulties with virtually every component of everyday life, to people who are really neat people, who are really competent and might just seem a little bit quirky.
Right.
You cannot set up a system for them in terms of early intervention or services and resources for them as they age, where one size fits all.
Right.
But at the same time, and this is one of the points I want to get at today, that doesn't mean it's sort of a free-for-all, because we do know, based on the last 15, 20 years of scientific research on the nature of autism, that no matter what your, in quote, severity, no matter what symptoms you may be showing at any given point in time, and those symptoms, as you know, change over time, that just because you have a high degree of self-stimulatory behavior at 2 or 3 years of age doesn't mean that will continue throughout your life. There is a learning process and a developmental process that interacts in a very complex way. But we do know that everyone from the most severely impacted to people who really have a great deal of potential have the same sort of underlying core problems, right? Yeah. Failure to develop neural integration, and as a result, the failure to develop dynamic intelligence. The way I see services and resources developing for adults is that you certainly cannot move towards a bureaucratic approach because of the extreme variation in symptomology, but there has to be a core approach that I believe is, let's call it relationship-based, but I want to talk about it in terms of active support because it comes out of a whole range of analysis over the last 30, 40 years that's separate and not necessarily connected, independent and parallel streams of analysis and research that fit very well with the principles of RDI, but have arrived at the conclusions independently.
Yes.
And I think, the starting point is that we really have to give concrete meaning to the things that people pay lip service to, like choice and dignity and lifelong learning, in the context of our understanding of autism. And I firmly believe that lifelong learning is a right and a necessity for everyone, but it really is a right and a necessity for people with ASD, given the nature of the disability.
Absolutely. And you know, we're going to take just a quick break. And when we come back, I want to continue this discussion. And I actually have a question for you. So we're just going to take a short commercial break. And when we come back, we will continue our discussion with John DeMarco from Canada, talking about adults in need of services and living and ongoing learning resources. And we'll be right back.
Hopefully, you'll never have to experience a disaster such as a fire or a flood striking your home or business. But if you do, know there's someone out there who can quickly help you get life back to normal. That someone is ServiceMaster by Disaster Professionals. Just call 602-431-2222, and our professionals will be there to lend a hand. You can be confident knowing ServiceMaster Clean has over 50 years of experience restoring damaged homes and businesses after frightening events such as fires, floods, vandalisms, and other disasters. We can offer services such as emergency cleaning, smoke, soot, and odor removal, in addition to water and fire damage repair. Our solid reputation is the reason insurance companies nationwide know ServiceMaster Clean will get the job done quickly and professionally. Plus, we guarantee to do the work right the first time, or we'll do it over with no questions asked. That's ServiceMaster Clean. We're the company that's first to respond to your call, first to arrive on the scene, and first to guarantee relief. Because delays and hassles are the last thing you need. Remember, 602-431-2222 for ServiceMaster Clean by Disaster Professionals. And get the clean you expect and the service you deserve.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Welcome back to Understanding Autism. I am Kim Isaac, and I am here with my awesome co-host, Paul Loudon.
Hi.
You know, I realize, Paul, too, that we always forget to introduce ourselves. People who were listening for the first time might be like, who are these guys? So anyway, I'm Kim, and I'm an autism specialist and a certified RDI program consultant and a co-host of this radio show. I've been involved with autism for about 16 years now.
And I'm Paul. I have been involved with autism all of my life because I am diagnosed with Asperger's. I was diagnosed a little bit less than 7 years ago and have been working on it since then.
Yes, and we have our special guest here on the line, John DeMarco, calling all the way from Canada, who's also a certified RDI program consultant as well as has involvement in many other organizations. And so, John, just before the break, so we got into, you know, some of the core of this topic. You know, here we have this crisis in services for people with autism, and really stemming from people needing the clarity of what it is we're actually looking at, you know, what are we being faced with, you know, from these adults who have benefited to varying degrees, of services. And you mentioned, earlier on in the show that you felt to approach it from more of an RDI principle standpoint. Now, I just wanted to focus on some people don't know what RDI is, and it's actually relationship development intervention, and I can provide a link for that on our Facebook. But I guess more specifically, when you say those principles, what are you referring to in terms of those core deficits or the principles that you have in mind in particular?
Well, it's I actually don't want to reveal that now. I wanted you guys to reveal that in the course of the conversation.
Ooh, okay.
I'm going to talk about two different models that have been put forward as alternatives to the current form of services for people with developmental disabilities.
Okay.
Both of which I think fit with RDI. And I thought that you could pull out where you saw it fitting.
Okay.
Rather than me sort of monologuing, going, and this is another RDI principle.
Okay.
What I like about this is that what we have now, for various reasons, is the convergence of, let's call it a relationship approach, because that's the simple way of putting it. The notion of active support or active engagement that I'm going to talk about as a way of organizing resources and services for people with developmental disabilities is primarily based on relationships. The model of housing and residential service that has been developed in Denmark for people with dementia, again, focuses on relationships. And when I was going through the literature on this, I could pull out, well, this is an example of guided participation. This is an example of reflective practice. And I think there is, you know, a need for a real analysis here. But at this point, my real point is to say I don't want this to be, I'm an RDI consultant. RDI has these principles which I think really are the core of intervention for people with autism. What I want to say is there are many people who have come to the same sort of conclusions from different perspectives, and that this is part of a larger process, or let's say that RDI fits within a larger umbrella of changing perspectives across a whole range of issue areas, ranging from aging and dementia to the work on interpersonal neurobiology that's been done by Daniel Siegel, working on all sorts of psychological issues, to revamping the way in which services, the old style services for people with developmental disabilities, have been implemented. So can I start to talk about that a bit?
Absolutely.
Okay. I guess the point that I want to set the stage is to sort of articulate why I think we need to be talking about the things that I've just mentioned. I mean, if you start looking at newspapers or advocacy organizations, I mean, in the last 6 months or so, there's just article after article on the coming crisis, the tsunami. And it really is a crisis. If you look at it in the larger context of challenges we face, let's say in North America, but also Western Europe, we've got, a situation of my generation of baby boomers aging, living a lot longer with chronic diseases. We have severe economic dislocation. The information today from Europe, 25% unemployment in Spain, climate change. I mean, the number of issues we have to deal with and the cost of addressing those issues is really enormous. And then we have added on to this what is perceived to be this incredible need that, again, is going to be very, very costly. And what you get if you look at advocacy organizations, and this is where I differ or start from a different point, is that their analysis starts, yes, the need is going to grow. We need to be prepared. For example, where I live in Toronto, in Ontario, there is a 20-year waiting period for group homes.
20 years? 20
years.
Wow.
Yeah. That's that's before the wave hits, right?
Wow.
Right? So that means, parents are going to be taking care of their adult children, but that's the way it's characterized. But adults with autism are going to be living at home. And if you talk to any parent, their biggest concern is what's going to happen after I die.
Right.
So it really is a dismal situation. But what comes out of that is that you'll see organizations doing a gap analysis, and they'll say, look, we need, given the numbers that are coming through, this is the current state of employment services, job coaching, this is the state of residential housing, this is the number of group homes, we will need this many more. Please invest money to build more houses, to provide more services. I think that that's a mistake, because I think that the way in which those services are characterized are basically extensions of the services that have been developed historically for people with developmental disabilities. And I think that the analyses of those services over the last 20 to 30 years, from the 70s on, up to a really depressing really depressing analysis in the New York Times in 2011 of the system in New York State, they really have not worked at all in any positive sense, certainly not in the sense that we've articulated in terms of lifelong learning and providing supports for people with autism to help them move forward. They are custodial. They are bureaucratic. Even though they may not reside in large institutions anymore, they are institutionalized, and they're primarily based on a relationship between staff and client, whereby staff does things to or for the people in their care,
right,
rather than engaging the people there in a relationship to do things together, which might be the first hint of the RDI principle.
Well, it is. And, you mentioned some terms earlier, and so not everybody knows our lingo, John. So that's why I just wanted to clarify. You're talking about that. So we have this relationship approach, or you've used the word, the term guided participation. And really, truly, I think what people don't understand is, well, that essentially means a person learning to learn from another person and actually mutually, going through processes together. And essentially, a student of any age learning to learn through the eyes of another and also learning about themselves. And I think that some people, and I'm just going to throw this in there, have said, well, these relationship approaches, you know, they're just creating dependency on another person. But actually, if you're approaching it from a guided participatory, you know, aspect, it's that you're actually, you know, connected with a person, understand where they're at developmentally, emotionally, you know, what their strengths are. And through relationships, which is how we do develop, you know, typically, you help them to learn and progress developmentally through, you know, relationships as they should have, but maybe at like a slower pace. And so people will say, well, you know, how are they going to be independent? But really, true independence requires interdependence. And I think that people forget that being interdependent and focusing on relational, you know, therapies or approaches is actually critical to independence. And when you leave that out, you have a lot of problems. And actually, let's take another short break. And when we come back, let's continue this discussion with John DeMarco from Canada. We're talking about the upcoming crisis here in services for adults with autism. We will be right back.
Are you standing at a crossroad in life wondering what's next? Is it time to reinvent your relationship, your career, your life? Whether you're ready for a reinvention revolution or a reinvention evolution, the support of a couple of great coaches can get you there. When you decide it's time to take your life from just functional to optimal, call Joe and Lori Battaglia of Living the Dream Coaches, 888-505-5762. That's 888-505-5762, or go online to www.livingthedreamcoaches.com. That's www.livingthedreamcoaches.com.
Hirschberger Assisted Living Home for the Elderly, whether it's a need to recuperate after surgery or just need daily assistance to enrich their life, you can trust that your loved one is being well cared for. Our caregivers are fully licensed by the Arizona Department of Health. An experienced team of professionals provide expert medical care, including physical, occupational, and recreational therapy, wound care, medication management, nutritional support, and personal care. All faiths are welcome. Hirschberger Assisted Living Home, founded in 1997, will provide your loved ones a quality of life with loving care. Call Shirley Hirschberger today at 602-314-6937. That's 602-314-6937, or visit the website ahomewithshirley.com. Hirschberger Assisted Living, home is where the heart is.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
Welcome back to Understanding Autism. And here we have our guest, John DeMarco. Here we're talking about the upcoming crisis here in services for adults on the autism spectrum. And just before the break, we were talking about the significance of relationship approaches in supporting these individuals and the importance of interdependence, which is really a word that isn't used very much in autism when actually it's probably the most critical concept. Oh, John, are you there? Okay. I just want to make sure you're still
No, absolutely.
Okay.
Let me, right, and See, I don't want to make the case that everything has to be I want to stress the thing that there are many people coming to conclusions from many different avenues.
Yes.
And it's a paradigm shift. And it's a paradigm shift that is based on 30 years of research with regard to what has been going on and how you might improve it. And so I don't want to make the case that this is just advocacy for RDI.
Of course, yes.
It's advocacy for the underlying principles, and more importantly, these principles are being articulated in many, many areas. Let me give you, are you going to be able to put the references to today's material on the Facebook
page? Yes, I will. Absolutely, yes. We'll do it
today. Okay, well, the material on active support or engagement that I'm using is from a book by Jim Mansell and Julie Beadle Brown. And this is stuff that comes from Australia, New Zealand, and England, not North America. But to quote Mansell, "We do not believe that it is possible to provide good quality of life for anyone in hospitals, villages, cluster housing schemes, or any of these other institutions that exist for people with intellectual disabilities. By their congregate and often segregated nature, the settings limit the opportunities for people to achieve the good quality of life they desire, in particular with regard to social inclusion, social relationships, and self-determination." One of the things that is an underlying theme or a current in the material on the way in which people deal with dementia in Denmark or this active engagement is an emphasis on decision-making and self-determination, which I think is really important. This may strike a resonance with you. Active engagement argues that a major social goal of services should be to enhance competence rather than just enhance skills. That engaging constructively with other people in the materials and tasks of everyday life is more important than just amassing skills which might in any case be lost if not used. What is the point of enabling people to engage in using leisure and recreational materials for short sessions each day when it has no impact on the rest of their lives? Activities need to be the real activities of everyday life rather than specifically set up as therapeutic interventions for the sessions. Now, does that sound familiar?
Well, it does, and it's, you know what? Hearing this, it's so powerful. It's very profound. I mean, it really is. It just really kind of reframes a person's mindset very clearly.
Yeah, it really does. Let me go to sort of the. There are many things in the active engagement literature that coincide with the way in which RDI has developed and evolved over time. But they have a number of principles that I think, again, will be something that those who are familiar with RDI will strike a resonance with them. These are the major components that they have distilled for active engagement. Teaching people principles and rationales rather than procedures, right? It's a competency rather than a skill base. Competencies lead to independence and decision-making, dignity, self-awareness, rather than an emphasis on being able to do a specific task in a specific setting. The importance of engagement in meaningful activity and relationships in the home and in the community. The primary teaching mode is through engagement with other people, and the terminology that they use in this literature is not the terminology we use in RDI, but it is the equivalent of scaffolding, of guiding, all the types of things that transfer, as you said before, rather than are geared towards achieving a certain outcome. They're designed to transfer ability and knowledge to build competency in the individual. And I think those principles are the ones that you can, that are common needs of all people with ASD, no matter what their level of quotes of functioning, no matter what symptoms they might manifest at any given time, you adapt your guiding in order to build the competencies that help that person develop and grow further.
Absolutely.
For all of these, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's very profound, though, and it's all connected. So, and, you know, yeah. I think that I really like the idea of seeing this, you know, the transfer process, because a lot of times, and Paul and I have talked about this on many, many shows, but focusing on rationale and competency, you know, explaining the why, helping to make visible the things that are invisible to people on the spectrum. You know, we do things, we have skills, we have behaviors, and on the outside they look one way, but things are going on the inside that are creating those outcomes. And I think it's very important. I mean, we're always talking about this, right, Paul?
Well, while he was talking about the whole transfer of skills things, I couldn't help think of the idea of, say, a parent with a child, and they're making peanut butter sandwiches in the kitchen. And they're doing it together. This is sort of the guided participation where they're doing it together. And if you had a child who was having difficulty with that, a lot of times the approach on the autism spectrum is to take a step back and do it in a very different way, to try to explain it, to try to make it a procedure with set specific things, cut the bread just like this. And that really, if you think about it, you know, you raise a kid typically a certain way with a lot of this, you know, participatory learning. And if you go and try to approach it from a completely different angle, you're going to expect to have a different outcome. That if you try to change the processes, rather than looking at that process of doing it with them and saying, how can I enhance this to fill in the areas that it's weak for them, where they're going to be weak learning it, if you go and do something completely different, you're going to have a different outcome.
And that's what ends up happening is essentially, I think that people on the spectrum, they actually, you know, people inadvertently sort of create alternate,
Well, I think that you sort of, when you follow down a different path of learning, when it's all structured like this, as he was talking about, the very bureaucratic, you know, the people who are just teaching, that you sort of end up at a different outcome than, you know, your goal. Well, I guess I see the goal of services as twofold. One is, what is the problem now? You know, that if a person can't walk, we figure out a way to make them walk. If a person can't, you know, live on their own, we figure out a way to fill in the gaps, basically, the filling in the gaps. And then the second goal is the long-term one, is how do we bring them closer to the life that everyone else gets to live? And that sort of seems to be where the weakness is that, you know, that it seems to be the goal is, how do we stop giving them services as soon as possible, rather than how do we get them closer to the life everyone else gets to live?
Right. And I think, John, when you were, you know, reading that insert there, I mean, that was really powerful in, I think, where are people's mindsets, you know, in that area is, yeah, let's just, you know, how can we just fix this, you know, not need so many services versus seeing it. And sometimes that even takes away, people don't consider the quality of life aspect of it. Or maybe they assume that, okay, I teach all these skills, you know, to a student, they've had all these interventions, that will automatically, magically transfer into quality of life.
Well, you know, in the active engagement stuff, they'll talk about the importance of data collection and objective measurement, but they will balance that with the felt experience of the person who's engaged in the activity.
Right.
Does it enhance that person's well-being? Can you discern that? Does it make a difference in their life? And that is, relationships are not necessarily efficient, but they are effective.
Yes.
They may be messy in their implementation, but they produce outcomes if you persist, good outcomes if you persist at them. But that goes against basically the bureaucratic factory-oriented model that we have used to deliver all social services. And in situations of economic distress and high need, my sense is that services become more bureaucratic and geared more towards the numbers rather than the outcomes as we would perceive them. Mm-hmm. I can give you just, I want to finish off a little bit here, more quotes from this basic components, because again, you'll see from your perspective how they fit very much, even though they differ in some ways with the basic thrust of RDI. So other key components of active engagement are the use of all opportunities arising during the person's day, rather than just a few activities chosen by staff. That principle is every moment has potential. Managing the level of demands on the person being supported by offering many opportunities to participate for relatively short periods. That's the principle of little and often. These sort of fit with the way Paul was conceptualizing it. Replacing a strict hierarchy of levels of assistance with finding the kind of assistance the person likes best and rapidly moving to whatever level of help is needed, graded assistance to ensure success. Taking account of the preferences and agendas of the person being supported and emphasizing the importance of maximizing choice and control. And while those of us who are RDI consultants or engaged in RDI may quibble and differ with regard to the way we interpret some of these things, it's clearly within that realm of relationship and learning through relationships and approaching the way in which you support and guide and engage that is very much different from the mainstream thrust of social services as they're currently understood and delivered.
Absolutely. Yes. And you know what? We're going to take another very short break. And when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with John DeMarco, all the way from Canada, calling in, talking about the upcoming crisis in services for adults on the autism spectrum. All right. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
Hirschberger Assisted Living Home for the Elderly, whether it's a need to recuperate after surgery or just need daily assistance to enrich their life, you can trust that your loved one is being well cared for. Our caregivers are fully licensed by the Arizona Department of Health. An experienced team of professionals provide expert medical care, including physical, occupational, and recreational therapy, wound care, medication management, nutritional support, and personal care. All faiths are welcome. Hirschberger Assisted Living Home, founded in 1997, will provide your loved ones a quality of life with loving care. Call Shirley Hirschberger today at 602-314-6937. That's 602-314-6937, or visit the website ahomewithshirley.com. Hirschberger Assisted Living, home is where the heart is.
Hi, I'm Paul, and I'm on the spectrum.
And I'm Kim, and I'm an autism specialist.
The second Monday and Tuesday of each month at 3 p.m. on 1010 a.m.
and online at breakradioshow.com, live and archived.
We're here to help you with
Understanding Autism. Welcome back to Understanding Autism. And just before the break, we were talking about the concepts of active engagement and quality of life and relational approaches to supporting individuals on the autism spectrum. And I can't believe how much time has gone by. We're kind of at the last segment of the show. I feel like, John, we could probably do five shows with you on this stuff.
Well, I think, you know, there's something that one of the things that I would recommend is that people listen to the documentary Dementia in Denmark that comes out of a CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation radio program. It's available on iTunes and also from the CBC website, because in fact, it's not just a documentary where you have experts speaking, but you have the people with dementia speaking. And the things that they say are very different than what you might expect, and very much in keeping with the themes that we've been sort of trying to illuminate today.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that. I'm definitely going to post those resources that you've sent us for our listeners on our Facebook page.
And I can. That would be great. I can talk about a couple of things that flow, because what, you know, the interesting point might be, people listening, is what's the relationship between autism and dementia?
Right.
You know, so to speak.
Right.
Apart from a neurological problem, but the issue, the thing that I found was striking, and I can start off with a few quotes. This is a quote, and they're is interesting. This is a quote from one of the. Let me talk about the structure a bit, because this does the way in which they organize the structures, I think, of delivering service and creating the potential for engagement and relationships really is fundamentally different than what we do in North America. If we go back to that first quote from Mansell, where he says that quality of life cannot be enhanced in congregate living settings, and I can make an aside there. Today in Ontario, they made an announcement about increased funding over the next 4 years for building more long-term care centers to deal with the aging baby boomers as we live longer with more chronic diseases. No one has said this openly, but the sort of underlying scuttlebutt is that as my generation of baby boomers moves through the system and goes into long-term care facilities, which are essentially congregate settings where you're just sitting around, despite sort of the overlay of activities and stuff, it's still a place where things are basically done for you or to you, that then adults with autism will then move as their wave comes in into these congregate settings. The interesting thing about the situation in Denmark is that they follow from this Mansell quote and say, you cannot have dignity and quality of life in those settings. So that the example used in the documentary as an illustration of an integrated community non-institutional approach is a 28-unit apartment building where there are 7 people there with dementia, and they live as a unit. It's really integrated in the community. It is really a situation that goes against the grain of the bureaucratic institutionalized approach, no matter how much we try to dress it up, that we use in North America. And that's the starting point. But interestingly enough, to give you a quote from one of the people with dementia, and this relates to the whole issue of productive uncertainty and risk, he said, adventure is still important. Risky business, you know. We feel alive. And then the documentary talks about how the question they ask is, what do you want to do today? And they ride bicycles, they walk on hiking trails, they sing together. And what is apparent as you listen to this is that they don't do these things as things in themselves. They may or may not enjoy these things or have enjoyed these things over the course of their lifespan, but they do these things as frameworks for relationships.
Yes.
And there's equality at mealtime. People basically are interacting and engaged with each other as equals. And the support that comes from those sets of attitudes, coupled with the idea that people with dementia have the right to choose and have the right to self-determination, flips everything on its head. There's another quote here that comes from the documentary. You can do a lot of things with dementia. You just need someone to understand who you are.
Oh, I love that.
And I think if you change dementia to autism.
Absolutely.
Coming from our perspective, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You can do a lot of things with autism. You just need someone to understand who you are. And in the documentary, you'll see a discussion, and it's not put within the same sort of, for example, theoretical framework that we would use as RDI consultants, but they will talk about the need for playfulness, the need to have a sense of fun, And it goes to the notion that the relationship is a relationship between, let's call them friends, as opposed to a contractual relationship between an employer and a patient.
And I think, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave with pretty much that thought.
The idea. We don't want to cut you off, but yeah.
Yeah, that there's really a big difference between a caretaker and a client and a relationship between people.
Yeah, and oh my goodness, John, we have like a minute and a half left in this show. That's why we could go on for a long, long time. And actually, we're going to ask you right now if you'd be willing to come back in the next couple of months and we can really go into this. You've sparked a lot of ideas, you know, in me, just, you know, quality of life and just really breaking this apart more. We really, really appreciate you calling in and sharing these thoughts. I'm going to post these resources for our listeners. And yes, we have just about a minute left. And Paul, you know what? Let's give a quick status on our website.
Well, there's not a status at the moment. We're looking forward to having one as soon as we can.
We're
but
on
we
the
don't
path.
Know.
Yeah.
Next week, we will have Lisa Simmons, who's written a book called I Would Have Said Yes about her experiences raising her autistic son. That'll be next Monday at 3.
Yes, and John, thank you again so much. It was a pleasure having you.
Thank you guys for having me on. Both take care.
Thanks. Let's talk soon, and we will be having you back.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Talk to everybody next week for more Understanding Autism.